This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show about the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Bennett. Today, we dedicate the full show to our interview with the architect and urban planner, Sir Terry Farrell. Do stay tuned. Sir Terry Farrell was born in Manchester in 1938, but it was during his childhood years spent in Newcastle that he decided he wanted to be an architect at all, at the tender age of 14, no less. Farrell went on to study at Newcastle University before completing a master's in city planning at the University of Pennsylvania in the US. Returning to England, he worked in partnership with the eminent Sir Nicholas Grimshaw for 15 long years before setting up his own firm, Farrell's. Sir Terry's postmodern buildings polarised the public, where vast structures such as the MI6 headquarters and Charing Cross train station in London rubbed up against and made light of the traditional buildings that abutted them. That's all before we mention the TVAM Studios, known now as the Breakfast Television Centre in Camden, a true exemplar of the postmodern genre, a joyous pastiche of style, colours and previously unmixed ideas that was completed in 1981. Since then, Farrell's reputation has rocketed as an urban planner and thinker, and his buildings can be found from London to Beijing. I had the good fortune to meet Terry Farrell recently and sat down with the maestro himself at Midori House here in London.
I got the impression that it's a fairly well-worn path. I was very keen on drawing and painting, and I used to paint landscapes and so on. And I was ill at home, and my mother was fed up because one of her boys, I was one of four boys, was at home. And she had persuaded me, or tried to persuade me, to go to apply to the civil service like her father.
A sensible job with a pension and a career progression.
Yes. And she argued with me that I could paint in the evenings and draw. And then I started drawing because I was invalid at home. I started drawing the house opposite. And she said, why don't you be an architect? And I looked at up what an architect was. And I went to work. My art teacher organized for me to go to work in an architect's office that summer. And I was hooked.
So of those two places, Manchester and Newcastle, they have a very particular vernacular, a particular look. Is that something that you kind of imbibed when you were younger, that you took in from around you, these industrial cities, these beautiful structures? Or is it something you reacted against, do you think?
No, I loved at the time Manchester, which I don't remember very much about because I was 8 when I left there. I grew up in Newcastle. I identify with Newcastle, and that's an extraordinary city.
And you obviously, which we'll talk about a little later, went on to do a lot of work in Newcastle, but
yes.
From master planning to the beautiful Life Centre there. But what I'd like to talk to you about is education and where education and architecture cross over. You were lucky enough to have a kind of lightning bolt of inspiration that it was a career path that you wanted to follow. But do you think enough children are encouraged to think about the built environment or to make the leap from painting to architecture, as you did?
And particularly in the what you might call the working classes and the lower middle class. It's a posh profession, is architecture. You need a moneyed client, and you tend to be old during your life, not doing the ordinary. And I think my bequesting the archive to Newcastle University, which I'm doing, will be an incentive for boys and girls, people like me, that will come from that kind of background.
So do you think we need to encourage a wider range of voices to talk about the city and to talk about architecture? You mentioned different classes, but I suppose different ethnic minorities and the imbalance of, I suppose, women who are architects as well. Do we all need to talk and have these urgent conversations about the city?
We need to have people involved in the environment, environment making and city making, who are from the broadest spectrum of the population, because the architects are just a fraction. They do just a fraction of what's needed and what's and city making is about. They do a small, posh spectrum.
I tend to agree with you. I'm going to ask you to fast forward. We've spoken a little bit about your childhood, but when you graduated, you took a bit of a plunge, a rather brave one, to work for yourself, not to go and work in the office of a well-known architecture practice, but to seek commissions on your own and do things under your own steam. If you could go back to that time now, what would you tell yourself? What advice would you give to
you? I've no idea, really, about what I would do right now. But I did then, in the 60s, just after I'd finished college. I was invited by a middle-class, well-heeled person that I'd befriended, Nick Grimshaw, to undertake a project for his uncle. And I set up from that point. And I only lasted 6 months working for someone else.
I feel like you're being very modest and putting it down to the luck of the commissioning, but it must have taken some drive, I suppose, and some grit to think to yourself, well, actually, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this on my own. I have a strong enough opinion about what I do and a faith in my ability to, you know, to run your own practice.
Well, I'm unusual. I'm the only one of my generation that earned his keep as he went. I relied upon designing an architecture as my sole source of income. And I have five children, and I moved homes, and I had the children all had comfortable homes and so on. And I earned it from architecture, which is unusual.
And is there any advice? We live in a world where the notion of entrepreneurship is kind of fetishized to some extent. Everyone has a project that they're working on, an idea that they'd like to bring to fruition. But what advice would you give after all the years that you've, as you say, run your own business to people that are starting out today? Or is the landscape so different?
I think the mold needs to be broken. It's got to be rewarding and financially have some incentive to work for other than libraries and art galleries or property developers. It's got to be the mold has got to be broken so that people are working where they're needed in this field. If you look around you, the streets and the houses and the hospitals are sorely in need of design and dedication of professionals that, whatever they are, you know, whether they're in surveying or landscaping or architecture or planning or engineering, they need to go about making the ordinary, the everyday.
Absolutely. And your vast range of work over these past decades defies description in the short and limited time that we have, from Charing Cross Station to the station in Shenzhen, embassies, factories and master planning projects. But I ask you, Terry, which of these projects do you remember most fondly?
Well, my standard reply is you're asking me to choose between my children.
Absolutely, and to do so in broadcast format, so it'll be immortalised.
Yes. I do remember some. They presented particular challenges, and they were the first. The Clifton Nurseries building were the first thing I did in my own right, where I split from Grimshaw in 1980. But TVAM, the headquarters of the television breakfast company, was a particular memorable.
So that's the project in Camden that has become so famous since you built it. And I wonder, Terry, are there some buildings that you'd rather forget?
Yes, I think there are some always that maybe I don't feel as proud of, but I won't mention them here.
You're too much of a gentleman for your own good.
Frank Lloyd Wright, I think it was, said that doctors can bury their mistakes, but architects can just grow ivy over them.
I think it was James Joyce that says geniuses don't do anything by accident as well. So perhaps maybe you learnt something from some of those mistakes that you made that you'll not tell us about now. I'm very privileged to meet talented architects such as yourself, and I remember I once met the Brazilian architect Issei Weinfeld, and I asked him if you could design any building, if I gave you carte blanche to design any building, what would it be? And he said a brothel. So Terry, if you could design any building, it doesn't have to be a brothel, but what would it be in your case?
I choose a brothel. Social housing is... housing, full stop, is a wonderful thing because you're making... with housing, you're making streets and gardens and much more. I like all projects. I wake up in the morning and the new challenge is whatever walks in the door.
It's interesting you should say housing because in your early career, you were given a lot more housing commissions, or you took a lot more housing commissions. I'm not sure how that came about. Your later career moved towards commercial buildings. Why is that? Just out of interest.
Well, individual houses, conversions, adaptations for developers or for owner-occupiers are small schemes, and that's where you start off. But I'm doing mostly housing now. I like doing housing. We did one or two well-known commercial buildings, and we're still doing them in China. But in this country, we're doing mostly housing work.
And it's interesting, I suppose, urbanisation is a watchword for everyone. Over half of the world lives in cities. Give it 30 years, it'll be two-thirds of the world. Yes. Do architects and thinkers about the urban environment, such as yourself, have a new and bigger challenge in light of the density of our cities, in light of giving people places to live that give them the respect that they deserve as human beings? Is there a bit of a crunch point for architecture at the minute when we look at cities?
It's not just the scale, it's the speed with which people are moving to cities. So it's scale and speed, which is absolutely extraordinary. We're now becoming an urban species. There's no escaping it. That the 21st century is going to be a century of city making. But that doesn't mean that architects are employed in anything like the extent to which they're capable. They have influence upon, I would guess, less than 10% of all the stuff that goes in to make a city.
And I've heard you talk favourably about maybe one of your childhood heroes, Ebenezer Howard, his Garden City movement. I heard you, maybe you don't like the project particularly, but Norman Foster's notion of an airport in the estuary. You've spoken about the idea that we should speak more openly about what goes on in our cities, and that architects maybe have some prerogative to provide ideas that they don't charge for, that kind of shape the urban debate. Is that something you still believe? Should architects be piping up?
I have a phrase that the place is the client, and which means that you don't get paid. So you go out and look at a place, and I take ordinary places. I don't take new city or the new airport. I take an existing hospital or housing estate, or I particularly take roads because the roads, all the buildings front onto them, and you get engaged very quickly in why the road is there. I did a study on the Marylebone-Euston Road, Pall Mall. I've reversed and changed one-way streets to two-way streets and so on.
And that was Sir Terry Farrell speaking to me, Josh Fenner. We'll be back with the rest of the interview after this.
Ever wondered about an architect? Puzzled over a phrase or pondered a product? Well, Monocle on Design Extra is our fleet-footed five-minute romp into an area of design that we think deserves just that little bit more attention. To join us on our weekly journey or dip into our fabulous back catalogue, you can head to monocle.com to download Monocle on Design Extra.
Now back to our interview with Sir Terry Farrell.
I think the Mayor of London has very limited powers. It's a token job. The politics of this country I've criticised since I got back from America, but America has got its own problems. I think political leadership isn't all it's cracked up to be. But I would look at housing and roads and all the things I've spoken about and argued for, about city making and so on. But I think that the mayor's position in London is a false one. He doesn't have powers, wide sweeping powers. He can't collect taxes.
Yeah, it always strikes me that a popular political decision isn't always a functional urban one. You know, you look at the prevalence of bike sharing schemes the world over. Half of them are installed in countries where you wouldn't be able to cycle for very long. You know, the bike share scheme in Morocco or Dubai spring to mind in cities that cannot sustain them. One thing I'd like to ask you about, Sir Terry, to move away from London as a topic. You're an architect, you have an appreciation for the world of design. Are there any objects that captured your imagination? I read somewhere that the Spitfire is a bit of an emblem for you. Can you tell me why that is?
That's because I live in a factory that made parts of Spitfires. The former Palmer Aero Works, and the Aero Works made wheels and brakes and such like. And it was requisitioned in the war to move from the East End. On a broader topic, I think wartime speeds up design. And I don't wish to have more wars, but it epitomizes the saying, never waste a good crisis. And I think we should look to war and peace. The bike share scheme, for example, it caught me by surprise. It took off. It's a good thing. And Uber taxis and getting about and automated vehicles. Well, I was at college in the 60s, and we were designing then for automated vehicles. They said they were coming in 10 years. But we're still waiting.
It remains to be seen the success of some of these things. Terry, some of your work has been very broadly categorised as sitting in what is now called the postmodern pantheon. Do you agree with such labels to describe the work of various architects and various styles over different decades, or do you think there's something more fundamental to architecture?
I think there's something much more fundamental in city making. But whilst it is haute couture for the posh, it will remain in the realm of fashion. I began as high tech 15, 20 years. I opened up through postmodernism a different debate, and I argue very strongly that postmodernism was a cultural way of seeing rather than a style. And I approached it as context, history, the city as it is, rather than utopian dreaming. And all my master planning work and planning work and was moulded by that. But as a fashion, it had a period.
And the thing I like about the postmodern way of seeing the world is maybe there's a bit more humour and a bit more humility and a bit more pastiche and a bit more, I suppose, wryness than the styles that maybe went before it, the humourlessness of modernism, the prescriptiveness of it all.
Well, modernism was very joyless in the 60s and 70s and 50s. Not so much the Festival of Britain, but it became joyless. And it's integrated now. We're all postmodernists, even modernists that have continued right through from early modernism, continued modernism in the 80s and 90s, and have emerged, changed and absorbed the influence of postmodernism and carry on. I think there are, like pop music, there are many styles today. Where once it was very style conscious. It was a very small group of people dabbling in fashion and clothes and design and architecture. Now it's like pop music, is you take what you want.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Terry, I have heard you make a comment which struck me as being very profound. You were discussing cathedrals and churches, and you said that people still go in to marvel at medieval or Gothic architecture, but they don't go in for the reason that that building was built. Is it ever okay to build a building that's just functional, knowing that human beings will probably come and use it for a different reason, whether it's converted into a shop or whether people just come to ogle at the fact that religion used to be so central to society? Is it possible to build a building for an exact function?
I think you have to be true to the materials and the opportunities of your time, but you have to expect, as a designer, an architect or a planner, that whatever use you were engaged to employ and use the building for, the brief changes almost as soon as it is finished. TVM was a seven-year franchise. They began to change it from the moment they occupied, and it's now something else. And I think all buildings have to be flexible. But I was brought up in a Catholic church. I was a Roman Catholic in my childhood. I've seen the church change. It's changed its rules in my lifetime. If it goes back 2,000 years as it does, what changes have come about then? And the cathedrals of the medieval times, or even pre- and post-medieval times, are magnificent. They're magnificent because my father-in-law was a bricklayer once, and I thought a lot about the people that go to make buildings, heroic buildings or beautiful buildings. They're all involved in sculpture and just simple bricklaying. So the art of building is capable of many hands over time, and they will keep making it their livelihood, and they get satisfaction from beauty.
And as a kind of towards the end of our conversation, as a sort of parting thought, we're sitting in London, a city where so much of your work has taken place, where you've obviously lived and thought and taken in all of the things happening. We won't talk about Brexit, but I think we should acknowledge that there is something in the urban fabric that's changing a little bit. Are you optimistic about London's capacity to continue to be a relevant city, just based on its built environment?
London's been very fortunate geographically, and there will always be a major city here. I remember the 70s when it was going down in population, and there was a location of Offices Bureau, LOB, where you couldn't build offices in the centre of London, and you got grants for moving out, and the population went down. All these things will go through phases. Right now we're in a phase of urbanisation, and we look at Lagos to Beijing or elsewhere, your Mexico City, all these places are growing. That's where you need the designers and thinkers to concentrate.
And lastly, you have a tremendous oeuvre of work that is built all over the world, and a kind of lineage of thought and thinking about master planning that would be heeded for generations. But you continue to work, and you have an office in the Far East. Is that where you see the benchmarks of urbanism being for the future? Or is that a market that you feel you can have some more influence on in a less staid way than perhaps London is? Why the fascination with the Far East?
Well, the action is there. Most architects like to live in Hampstead or San Francisco or on Greenwich Village, but the work is elsewhere because you're changing, you're building new. And most architects wouldn't live in the new. I know very few architects that live in new buildings because it takes a while to bed down. It needs layers of history to make it a good place.
And are you ever afraid or afeared of being the person to build the new thing?
I build new and I have to build new. That's the way the economy works for architects. Mind you, I think we should be employed much more to think about the council housing estate of the 60s, the hospital of the 50s, 60s, 70s, the schools. We need to, they aren't employed, architects. There's no money in it, but you need other minds apply themselves to it because the changes happen all the time.
But you're optimistic about the future of architecture, about the future of the career that you've devoted yourself to for these decades and scaled the heights of?
I think where I'm optimistic is, that it's spread now. The School of Architecture I was in was an ivory tower for all male. There was one female in the final year, and she left, leaving us all male. There was 120 students in total. Now the School of Architecture is many, many hundreds. In fact, first year is more bigger than the whole school was then, and it's more than 50% female. So I'm optimistic in the sense that we're all getting much more education. They're becoming a flatter line economically. We're all living more comfortable lives.
That was architect, urban designer and all-round good boy Sir Terry Farrell speaking to me about his fated career, work and thought. My sincere thanks for him for taking part in the show. Sadly, that's all we have time for today. And don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you could, of course, subscribe to our sister show, the brilliantly imaginatively named Monocle on Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You could also pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine or one of our many beautiful books. Monocle on Design Extra was produced by Daphne Karnizes and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.